just a second, to take a break, but I want to point out one thing. You see my handout, that long, thick one? Would you just look at the front cover of that? And would you look at the little table? And in there you see that something that says helpers for education research. You see that section? You might circle that or call it BAM. In there, I want you to write down working paper number 265. 265, when you click on that cell, it'll open up a bunch of papers that you can look, download HTML paper. The one called 265 was a paper that their thing inspired me to write, and I actually sat down with learning theorists on this. Some really top, one was the editor of the of a top leading psychology journal on experimental psychology. And I began to see parallels with their results and the results of metacognitive researchers. The only thing is that metacognitive researchers often dealt with more simple tasks, like remembering names and things like this, whereas intermediate accounting is a lot more complex. But the parallels were so frightening, or not frightening, surprising.
The magazine listed the University of Illinois as one of the most fired campuses in the United States. And yet, despite that, the most frequent complaint was lack of computer access. There are more computers on campus at Illinois than almost any other educational institution in the United States, and students still complain about the lack of computer access. That's a major impediment, then, to any other institution that wants to put in place ALM programs. Part of the problem here, you know it, you hate it, Napster. The ALM programs were coming online at the same time. Napster, does everyone know what Napster is, by the way? No, some people don't. Okay. Napster is some really nasty software that enables you to get music from other people's hard drives all over the world. And I confess I've used Napster, although I don't have anything to leave with it. The problem was at University of Illinois, the network lines were so clogged with students downloading Napster files that the legitimate academic business couldn't be conducted on this network. So what has now happened at the University of Illinois is Napster is banned software. This problem has largely disappeared since Napster was banned. But you know what? Next year, it'll be another piece of software that will keep up the networks. Because it's fun, right? And it's fun for students to do it sort of. So the lack of computer access was a network problem at U of I, probably caused by Napster before the ban. And things have gotten better since then. But it still surprised me that even at University of Illinois, with all the technology we've got there, it's still a problem getting these on these machines. System availability and support. 50% of our students love computers, and they'll do anything you ask them to do on computers. 70% about are in a group where if it's not too hard, they'll do it. And about 50%, unless you make it really easy for them, they're just not going to do it because they don't have the motivation to do so. For that 15%, I couldn't log on, so I stopped using it. Well, if you would have asked the person next to you, they probably could have helped you get on, but they're just not that interested in doing it. Too many systems crashes, and so I stopped using them. Both of these are quotes from students about why they didn't like the ALM experience. And by the way, the system crashes had to do with Napster also. One of the major research evaluations in the SCALE project was, did ALM improve course efficiency? I want you to be very careful and think about what we mean by improving course efficiency. As an instructor working in an ALM environment, I didn't get any extra money. I didn't get any course release time. This was time I took away from other things that I could have been working on. So, in terms of my personal efficiency as an instructor, this was an inefficient thing for me to do. But I like technology, I thought it'd be fun, I thought it might be useful to students, so I did it. In the ALN evaluation set by SCALE, they omit instructor time as a cost. And I want to tell you, the cost is pretty high if you've never gotten involved in this kind of software before. There's a fairly high startup cost, despite the fact that the products are much more mature than 5 years ago. Here's this quote again, I put it before. ALM teaching is arduous from an instructor interview. Some people went into this thinking, this is great. I don't have to show up for class every week now. I don't have to prepare my lectures the way I once did. They got a hard lesson that, in fact, there's a whole lot more setup and prep time to do an ALM class than to do a traditional class. So, the first caveat is, this is from the perspective of the university, not the individual instructor. Did ALM improve course efficiency? Never for small or writing-intensive classes. ALM was tried in small and intensive, writing-intensive classes, and has largely been abandoned at University of Illinois in those two sets of classes because it increased costs and because it led to some dissatisfaction with students and instructors. Yes?
We're using it in the freshman class, in the writing, and with immediate feedback to students. The students also cross line among themselves. And it seems to be working quite well, at least hopefully, largely safe. Their writing skills improve.
So tell me how writing is great. They're submitting their sounds electronically.
Everything is being done.
And they're getting back electronically. Okay, so maybe then we could say.
There was also, I believe, I'm not completely familiar with it, but the my understanding that they're also submitting it to the peers and getting comments back from their peers, et cetera. They're getting a quote from help in restructuring the essay or whatever. The freshman class is definitely in the short, the writing, initial writing skills class.
So tell me now, what are the resources that you are devoting to grade writing in this unit relative to what was done before you set up an ALM class? Are they the same? Are they less? Are they more?
It's definitively more, again, on the instructor side. Uh-huh. All right. Now, whether they all have TAs or something, I don't know.
So the acid test there, I'm with you on effectiveness will work here. I think you can do writing-intensive classes and have them be very effective in an ALM environment. But the issue would be, are you using either have you increased class sizes with the same for instructors, or have you been
it's
able...
limited, I know that.
Yeah. So the real issue would be, what resources are you using now versus what were you using before?
I definitely don't know that.
And that'd be a real interesting one to find out. Because that would speak to this thing of, at least at Illinois, when they tried writing-intensive classes, we found that we couldn't save resources doing it. The effectiveness seemed to be about the same, because there's the online interaction, the feedback may be more frequent. They can use things like software to help them check grammar, spelling, all this.
Yeah, and that I've heard is one of the things, again, that they didn't have to spend as much time doing that as they had to.
Sure. I wouldn't want to say that this is impossible. It is only from the scale experiment, and this was, you know, what it said of classes over 4 years. Yes, sir.
I want to ask a question back to students about the student use of discussion rather than chat room. You mentioned that they felt that they got information from the students, but also that they had to have it incorporated. So the ratings had an incentive to use it. So did you have different classes where it was really simple, just offer the opportunity to use discussion webs and make them happen?
Some of the classes set up, for example, quizzes and homework that was optional online. And of course, none of the students responded to that. They didn't do it. There was no reason for them to do it.
How did you separate those?
Well, my sense was that the top 5 or 10% would be involved in that sort of thing, and the rest of it would really cost students more than most of the rest. Just ignore it.
I know one aspect that got around that was on every exam, there were a couple of questions that came up out of the voluntary. So after a while, you got to realize you could get 15 or 20% right off the top without you were being given that.
And another approach has been to have online immediate feedback quizzes where those are graded for real. And the security issues with respect to those are less than you might think they are. There are security issues and control issues with respect to them, but they're not horrible.
Yeah.
Question I wonder about.
Say it all in speaking here.
Pardon?
Just say it all in speaking here.
Okay. On the discussion web, what I'm wondering is, are they used because it's neat technology and you want to force the students to get on the discussion web to do it, or is it used because there's some education value of using the discussion web?
Yeah. And I think this leads back to the point of Michael?
Steve.
Made earlier of, for example, one thing Lanny did that was interesting was at the start of every week, he would post some article, he'd post a website address for an article in the New York Times about economics. And then there would be points assigned. The students contributed to the discussion about that article and related it to their class experience. So the beauty of that was students could come in and read what other people had read, think about it, and make a comment about it. Now, the reality of that was some of those comments were very thoughtful and provocative, and some of them were less provocative. But at least it got students. Lanny from that got a much better sense of where his students are in relating whatever topic he was talking about to some real world event. So that when he went into the election later that week, he was much more armed with a sense of where the students were with respect to that issue. And he could then post those comments and say, here's how this relates or doesn't relate to that article. That, I think, was the pedagogy for the content value of having that technology.
I'm now going to give three examples of whether ALM improved the course efficiency. For each of these, there were assessments of end-of-semester exam performance for ALN versus non-ALN sessions, and they were identical. No statistically significant differences for each of these three examples I'm going to give. The first was introductory statistics. I'm good friends with the department chair of statistics at Illinois. The development cost of creating an ALN statistics class was funded by the Sloan grant, and the incremental cost of the ALN admissions initiatives was $1,000. It was adding a peer tutor each semester to this class. The ALN class sizes were 50% larger than the traditional sections. So they were running at 154 students versus 101. No differences whatsoever in terms of exam scores at the end of the semester. The incremental cost after development was $1,000. Of course, the university loves this. The students are just as satisfied. They're getting more students for the class, and there's no difference in grades. One example of improving course efficiency. This is Lanny's class, econ, or micro econ. He tripled the section sizes from 60 to 180. The initial development cost was 56,000. The incremental cost is about 1,000 a semester also. No differences in end of semester test scores, no difference in student satisfaction with the courses in these ALN classes versus non-ALN. The introductory Spanish is a bit more of an interesting one, I think, in that it's a language-intensive class, gets a bit closer to this writing-intensive issue. They doubled the section sizes. There was a one-time development cost of 15,000. Exam scores were the same. Student evaluations were the same. Three examples of cases where technology seemed to increase the efficiency of the course. Here is the one that I think, if you're here as a program administrator, as a dean, as an associate dean, as a director of the school, as a department head, this is one that I think is a little odd. Lee Esterbrook is the dean of the School of Library and Information Science at the University of Illinois. Lee Esterbrook launched an initiative called the LEAP program, the Library Education Experimental Program. This is an online program that is accredited by the ALA, the American Library Association. It is an almost entirely online program. Students come to campus for 2 or 3 weeks at the start of the semester. They come for a couple of weeks at the end of the semester. Other than that, it's an entirely online program. It started with 31 students in the fall of 1996. It currently has 125 students. About half of them are in the state of Illinois. The other half are spread around the world. And I'll give you a sense of that on the next slide. As of 1999, 96 students have completed the program. They were from 37 states, including rural Illinois.
areas of Illinois that would have had no access to the University of Illinois whatsoever. Virgin Islands, France, Colombia, Japan, and Thailand. Every faculty in the College of Library Science teaches at least one online course per year. The last part of the slide is music to your ears if you're looking to increase the funding for your department, for your college, for your unit. The Graduate School of Library and Science has added 4.5 full-time faculty in the last 4 years because of this program. Their budget has grown by $750,000. That is university money. That's not outside money. In addition to that, they have subtracted soft money because of the success of this program that has allowed them to build a new building on campus. Contrast that with the business school of the University of Illinois, where none of this has happened. What has happened here is the university administration has looked at this program and said, this is a shining star success of our university, and we are going to back a winner. We are going to put our money behind this program. If you can launch this kind of a program and make it work, I guarantee dollars will flow your way. And Lee Estherwick was really remarkable in her success in pulling this program off. Okay, so do the scale results suggest that ALM can improve access to higher education? The LEAP program makes that evident in the sense of the evidence seems to suggest the LEAP program is not stealing people who are going to enroll in other library science programs. For example, these 37 people that live in small towns in Illinois did not have access to a graduate program in library science until the LEAP program came into existence. They are now getting master's degrees in library science, whereas they otherwise could not have done that in any obvious way. Yes?
I was going to ask about the LEAP program. I thought it was very, very good that we talked about the chance that that's self-selection in each course. What about the LEAP program? I mean, maybe it was just an exceptional administrator that if she didn't have a computer to use, she would have used something else.
I don't think so, in the sense of this was what the University of Illinois was looking for, a flagship program to sell all of the units on the value of launching this learning program. And she happened to be in the right place at the right time to launch this program. In addition to that, this is a top five library school in the country. So people all around the world want to get degrees. So I think it was sort of a nexus of favorable events that this program was so successful.
Okay, the bottom line. So if we reflect on all the scale experiment stuff, what does this mean to you as you go back to your institutions and think about, do I want to do this, and what needs to be in place if I'm going to do this? The first thing I would suggest is support the top for technological innovation. Lee Estherbrook, the dean of the Library and Science School, said, we are going to do this. The faculty is excited about it. She's been able to add faculty that are even more excited about it. The administration said, you are our stars. Go for it and make it happen. Some level of technological support and incentives for participation are critical. But the interesting thing is, Lee went to the faculty and said, if we build it, they will come. Nobody even said, we're going to give you a bunch of money to do it. They did it on faith, and they built it, and the student came, and the money came. So Lee's charisma and vision are much of what made this possible. It wasn't, give me the money, and then I'll do it. It was, we're going to do it, and then we'll get the money. And I think that's the right order of events to make these things happen. Secondly, pedagogically sound content. I think your question was a very good one. Is this really just using some silly technology to do something you could have done just as well in a face-to-face environment with handouts? The pedagogy has to be mixed with the media in a way that makes it effective. And I think, for example, online conferencing can be used very effectively that way, where students really do want answers to questions in the middle of the night, and if a peer is up at the same time, they can help one another. An enthusiastic and committed faculty and
Sorry, you mentioned that one a few times, and I always keep thinking to myself, well, they're up in the middle of the night, they can answer the phone as easy as answer email. So what does technology contribute to that?
I'm at least a little reluctant to call in the middle of the night, but I'm not reluctant to email in the middle of the night. So that may not be true for 19-year-olds, I'm not sure.
Asynchronous first makes a difference to if there's a discussion. The answer may already be out there. Or if you post it and you better, you should check it later.
Right.
Yeah, that's true, that a phone right. call is to one person, whereas a post be to everyone on that conference.
Right.
Well, here's an interesting split. The research on technological adoption, there are waves of adoptees, normal curve, that sort of thing. For about 15% of faculty, support staff, students, these are the bomb gens in the world, that if you don't get in their way, they're going to innovate, they're going to do great things, and they're going to lead the rest of us into innovation. Most of us are probably more in that middle group of after we've seen Bob pioneers, we're going to be willing to try it and put it in our classes. But then there's this great laggard group, and I've heard when I've given this presentation before, somebody raised their hand and said they thought 60% of accounting faculty were the latest on. I don't want to comment on that. I could get into trouble. Certainly my colleagues at the University of Illinois and the Department of Accountancy were not strongly on the left side of the distribution. They were more on the side of, we want to wait and see how other people are. Getting a sense of where your faculty are with respect to their willingness to innovate and adopt, I think, is critical. Because different incentives motivate these people. The first group, if you don't get in their way, they're going to make great things happen. The second group have to be shown the value of it, the Lee Estabrook approach. And the last group have to be dragged along, presumably, through a different set of incentives. So a wired computer literate students and faculty makes a big difference. Thoughtful consideration of content ownership issues. My friend Brian Wansink, who created this wonderful online case study, did it all himself, and still the university is saying, well, you did that on university time and under university contract, so shouldn't we get some portion of the royalties from that? Working out those issues in advance, who owns what, who's going to have accessibility, who's going to own the product when it's done at a critical moment, particularly with publishers and university. Some great articles on that recently in the Chronicle of Higher Education. Development programming support, access to student computing, and the products are getting better now, and that helps a lot. Marketing to students, current faculty, administrators. The question you always have to answer is, what's in it for the students, what's in it for faculty, and what's in it for the administrators? And if you can't answer that, it's going to be a struggle. For example, Lee Estabrook could answer those questions. What's in it for the students? They're going to get access to a program they didn't have before. What's in it for the faculty? They have more travel money. They have more resources. They're now at a flagship program. What's in it for the administrators? A new building, a whole bunch more soft money, that sort of thing. Finally, what's the goal? And that's come up a couple of times, and it's a great question. Is it to improve class content and availability? Is it the technology that's the content? Or is it some richer form of media that we want to use? There are the references and resources that I mentioned before. And if you want to contact me, please use my Illinois email address for the next couple of weeks, and then the other one will be available. And my phone number is, why can't I get from here? Oh, here we go. Here we go. Let me put my phone number up here and we're done. Well, it's late in the day. I'm willing to entertain questions, but if we're all done, I'm not offended if all things are over again.
That's awesome. That could be incentives. I always had a few rounds of promotion of that, and all the great teachers, not one of them got promoted. Those who got the technology passes. I don't know the situation is here in America, but this feeling now that why should we bother? Because those who didn't do it, the lay guys, all got promoted because they sat back and did their research. Those who invested some time in this got no rewards. How do you counter that?
Got any ideas?
Well,
I think it's a real tough question. But the other interesting thing is, if you look at the top 20 research institutions in accounting, very few of them are leaders in the technology area. They're choosing to focus on exactly what you suggested, publishing the traditional accounting journals where the traditional words have been found. So I think if you're, let me be just brutally honest with you. If you want to get promoted, don't do any of this stuff. Do it after you get tenure. And I did some of it before I got tenure. I did some of it after. But I didn't do so much of it before I got tenure that it got in the way of my research record. But there's no doubt about it. It's a dangerous career strategy at the earlier ranks. Do other people have thoughts about that? That's my opinion on that one. Yes?
The economics course when I went to asynchronous, was there no lectures or any class meetings at all? Or just...
It was Lanny's class, when he did this, he had one lecture a week, which would be in the second half of the class. Or it would be on Thursday. On Monday, he would post some discussion questions. He'd post an article from the New York Times about economics. And the first half of the week, they were responsible for reading the material and making posts at the conferences about what they thought about the material, what they learned from the material, the reactions to it. And then Lanny would come in on Thursday and hit those points that seemed to be needed to address the issues that came up during the week. So he tried to do it with sinking them, throwing them in the water first and seeing what they had learned, what they had not learned, and then building his lectures around what seemed to be unclear later on.
And this meeting was a much larger class than the comparable class.
It was 180 instead of 60 students, that's right, which he had had before.
So they did as well and certainly were efficient. Any feeling about how to see it?
The interesting, and I didn't say this very explicitly, the averages for all of the range of the classes were about the same, but the variances in the ALN classes were higher. And for those of you that have forgotten statistics, what this would mean is the ALN students, some of them really liked it and some of them really didn't like it, which probably makes some sense because it was an innovative approach, whereas the traditional students were more homogeneous in how they felt about the class. The means were about the same, but the variances were higher in the ALN classes.
Thank you, Dan.
Thanks for your time.